the Supreme Court suspends Curtis Hill. Woody Myers picks a running mate, plus a first look at how widespread COVID-19 is in the state, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending May 15th, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, the Indiana Supreme Court ruled Attorney General Curtis Hill's law license will be suspended for 30 days and automatically reinstated. The Indiana Supreme Court unanimously says Curtis Hill criminally battered four women at a party in March 2018. The court's ruling comes in a state disciplinary case against the Republican elected official. A hearing officer in that case recommended Hill's law license be suspended for 60 days without automatic reinstatement, which would have meant Hill was without a valid license for months. But the state Supreme Court says while Hill committed misdemeanor battery worth a 30-day suspension, his actions after the allegations became public do not sufficiently indicate he was without remorse, and so his license should be automatically reinstated. What does this mean for Curtis Hill's future? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, I've asked this question many times, but we now finally have a concrete result. Does it change anything for Hill's chances at re-election?
Well, you know, if we had a governor that had some leadership potential, he could step right in now and he could say that the requirement for the Indiana Code is that the whoever's occupying the office of Attorney General have a valid license to practice law. His license is suspended. The governor can come right in and say that office is now vacant and I'm appointing a successor. He's not doing that. I mean, any more than the Republican supermajority in the legislature did anything about this. My husband introduced a bill of impeachment and it didn't even get a hearing. If they are embarrassed by this attorney general, and they should be, the highest law enforcement officer in the state groped four women and then tried to use state funds to fight it and tried to deny it and changed his story and did all of those things. And it's absolutely unacceptable that this person is the highest law enforcement officer of the state of Indiana. But the Republicans are not prepared to take him out because they're afraid of the radical right in their own party. And so he may be the nominee of the Republicans for attorney general again, because the governor doesn't have the leadership capacity to act as he should.
I want to get to more of what Governor Holcomb is trying to do, which is asking the Supreme Court to do what Ann just suggested. But Mike O'Brien, first I want to ask you, does the Supreme Court saying in a somewhat definitive way, yes, he did these things, will that change anybody's mind?
Well, I hope so. I mean, we have legitimate and incredible candidates for attorney general who have filed to run in the convention. And if this has become very much an anti-establishment versus establishment, outstate versus Indianapolis within the party, which is ridiculous because what you're putting at risk if you're a conservative Republican planning to vote in this convention and a delegate in the convention to select our nominee for attorney general next month. But you do put this seat at risk by reelecting, and he clearly has a lot of baggage going into the general election. And if you're a delegate to the Republican convention, you're presumably a pretty conservative, engaged Republican, and you put everything else you care about, defense of life, defense of the Second Amendment, defense of health care, whatever you like that Curtis Hill has done, you put at risk by losing that seat in November.
Nikki Kelly, Ann Delaney raised the idea of Governor Holcomb trying to appoint a replacement during this 30-day suspension. Governor Holcomb wants to do that, clearly, or at least he's asking the Supreme Court if he can do that. Can you kind of bring us up to speed on what's happening there as we tape here on Friday afternoon?
Yeah, we have competing motions that were filed today. Obviously, Attorney General Hill is saying, whoa, we have no precedent for a governor to intervene in a disciplinary commission. And he says, you know, in the past, if occasionally a prosecutor has been suspended, then they literally just appoint a temporary prosecutor for that just the time of the suspension. So I think it's probably going to be pretty unlikely that they would especially let the governor fill the remainder of the term, maybe let him fill, you know, for someone to fill in for the 30 days.
And John Schwann is...
That's the problem. He can put the onus on Curtis. He can act. He can take what he thinks is the right step for the state of Indiana and fill that vacancy and let Curtis Hill carry the ball.
That's why he needs the Supreme Court to interpret this.
He doesn't need the Supreme Court to tell him that. He can do that.
The very reason the legislature had to clarify this is because it isn't clear, which is why the Supreme Court has to clarify it.
Yeah.
John
Schwannis, I wanted to ask you sort of what I've asked some of our other panelists, which is, and I've been asking this question sort of each step of the process, does this really change anything ultimately for Curtis Hill?
One would think that the wording of the decision that was handed down by the state's high court might change some minds, and that it was fairly definitive. I don't know how it could have been any more definitive that, in fact, there was conclusive evidence that he had done these things to the women who accused him of unwanted advances. It used words such as rude and insolent in the decision. It was unanimous. You would think that that might change some minds, but it does seem, and Mike certainly would have a better front row seat on this, being part of the party apparatus, that to the extent that minds could be changed, there's been ample time for mind changing along various stages of this saga. And it does seem that people are pretty dug in now on both sides. So it might change some minds of people, average Hoosier voters, and therefore maybe could affect the general election if, in fact, the attorney general was able to secure another nomination for another term. But the people who are going to be casting votes, ballots, I should say, at the state convention are not rank and file voters. These are people who get it, understand, and know where they stand on the issues and whom they like and who they don't like. Yeah. So I don't see it changing their minds necessarily.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. Now, on today's show, I've been asking our panelists a question I've been asking all along, so we're going to ask one of our viewers and listeners that we've been asking before. Will Attorney General Curtis Hill win re-election in 2020? A, yes, he will. B, no, another Republican will win. Or C, no, a Democrat will win. Last week's question, we asked you, what do you think of Governor Holcomb's plan to lift Indiana's stay-at-home order, which is now effective in almost the entire state? 59% say the governor went a little too soon. Only 7% say he should have gone earlier. And about a third, 34% say it was right on the money. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Indiana gubernatorial candidate Woody Myers finally named his running mate, former state representative Linda Lawson, will be the Democrats' candidate for lieutenant governor. Linda Lawson spent 20 years serving her Northwest Indiana House district. In a Facebook video, Myers says beyond her legislative experience, Lawson has spent her career breaking glass ceilings.
She is smart, experienced, and exactly what Indiana needs right now.
Lawson was the first female police officer in Hammond and the first woman to lead the Indiana House Democratic Caucus. The former lawmaker says she was intrigued by the opportunity to help Indiana recover from coronavirus and its economic effects. And she was inspired by Myers herself to join the campaign.
We need a doctor in the House. We need someone that the state of Indiana can believe in.
The Indiana Democratic Party will affirm Lawson's candidacy at next month's state convention. Mike O'Brien, I'll start with the very basic question. Is Linda Lawson the best choice for Woody Myers as a running mate?
I don't think she's the best choice. I mean, she appeared after last week to be the only option he had left. Her name was not mentioned at all through this process.
Well, yes, it was.
I don't think anything bad to say about Linda Lawson. She had a great career in the legislature and certainly her experience in law enforcement. But from a process standpoint, what was projected from the Myers organization was whole disorganization. The state party had to change the rules so he could go find a candidate because he ran out of time. You have a long shot candidate that nobody was really talking about before this. So She may be the best choice he had of the options available, which were one person.
And Delaney, it was a messy process to get to Linda Lawson as the running mate. Is that a problem?
Well, the obviously the coronavirus had an impact on all of this, but
you don't have to blame
she was
all.
On the short list from she was on the short list from the beginning of the selection process, Michael. You're absolutely wrong about that. And she's an excellent choice because she not only brings the law enforcement and the legislative experience, but she's been on the school board. She's lived in the northern part of the state and the southern part of the state. She's broken not just the first female woman, but the first captain who was female in the Hammond Police Department. So she's got an exemplary record, and she's a credit not only to her gender, but to the state of Indiana. And it's a very wise and very good choice.
John Schwanis, does Linda Lawson strengthen that ticket?
Well, I think conventional wisdom would dictate that she does strengthen it. If you look at it on paper, she checks a lot of the boxes that she would be looking for in terms of, well, Ann just mentioned the geographic representation here. Clearly, northwestern part of Indiana is a very important part of the state, maybe the most important part of the state for any Democratic candidate seeking statewide office. So that's a good thing. The law enforcement background. She's very smart, very energetic. That, on paper, all bodes well. But again, this is unlike anything we've seen before. I think you have to assume that going into the COVID-19 pandemic that Eric Holcomb was in the driver's seat. Indiana, as we've discussed many times on this show, has never fired an incumbent governor that was duly elected in his own right. Only an appointee effectively was turned out after a partial first term. So Hoosiers are instinctively, it seems, against replacing people midstream. And I don't imagine that anything we've seen with the coronavirus has lessened the incumbent's advantage at this point.
Nikki Kelly, we saw reports leading up to the decision to name Lawson as the running mate that the State Party Central Committee, we know it had to postpone the deadline. We heard reports that that one committee member said that the Myers campaign had to get their stuff together, only they didn't use the word stuff. Does that become a problem for the Myers campaign in the long term, or now that he's got his running mate, that's all left in the past?
Probably not in the long term, but I will push back a little. I don't think Linda Lawson was really on anyone's radar. They were really pushing toward Terry Gooden until, you know, a key part of the party pushed back due to his very moderate Democrat leanings on things like gay marriage and abortion and firearms. So Linda Lawson, I think, was chosen for the experience. I also think she's a lot more fiery and maybe a good contrast to a more low-key Woody Myers.
Oh, fiery is a great way to describe Linda Lawson. An estimated 186,000 Hoosiers either have or had COVID-19. That number is from initial results of a statewide study by the Fairbanks School of Public Health that was unveiled this week. The Fairbanks School tested about 4,600 people around the end of April, randomly sampled to replicate the demographics of the state's population. Nirmina Kemi helped lead the study.
This finding, along with the relatively low 2.8% prevalence, strongly suggests that our social distancing policies played a critical role in curbing the spread of the virus and containing it to within households as opposed to within the community.
The state has now loosened most of those social distancing policies. The Fairbanks study also suggests nearly half of all Hoosiers who are positive for the virus don't show symptoms. State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box says the study underscores the need to wear a mask when in public.
I really think that that would be a policy thing that I hope that some of our businesses take to heart.
Mask wearing is not required under the state's guidelines. Nikki Kelly, does it seem paradoxical to you that these officials would be saying, look at the evidence showing that we did the right thing with the stay-at-home order a week after they rolled back most of the stay-at-home order?
Yeah, definitely an interesting timing, I guess. I mean, it's fascinating that that shows kind of an 11 times more, like, you know, prevalence of the virus compared to the confirmed cases we had. And also, I think on the mask stuff, I think that's becoming more and more of an issue. And I don't really blame people for being confused. It's encouraged, not required. And for 2 months, people like Dr. Box and our U.S. Surgeon General were telling us not to do it. And suddenly now we should all do it to protect everyone. So I just think people are very confused on that particular item.
John Schwanes, does a lot of the information in these results seem to run counter to the decision made a week prior to start opening back up?
Well, you have to frame the terms here by which you're debating the issue. If you're talking solely about disease prevention or controlling the spread of the virus, I guess then you would argue that staying sheltering in place and wearing a mask if you do go out makes sense. However, the governor of this state and 49 other states are faced with a broader equation, which is also we can't worry solely about the spread of the virus, even though that's the primary concern, obviously, but also about the economy, the broader question of people's incomes, people's livelihoods, their ability to stay in their homes, to provide food for their families. And I think that becomes part of the calculus here. So you can wear the hat of a public health official and come up with one conclusion. You can wear the hat of a titan of Wall Street, come up with another conclusion. And I think most governors, including this one, are probably trying to find the middle ground.
Mike O'Brien, I want to ask specifically about masks. In the press conference where they released these results, multiple people stress the importance of social distancing and mask wearing when you're in public around other people. Dr. Box, the week before on a Friday, went over the importance of mask wearing and even demonstrated the right way to put it on, take it off, how to handle it while you're out in public and or around other people that you're not living at home with. Why is it just optional?
Well, I think one thing we learned this week from Wisconsin is that if you make it mandatory, well, then the next question, if you play that out, what's the next question? Well, how are you going to enforce it? Are there teeth in it? Is there a fine? Is there jail time? And the Wisconsin Supreme Court came in and said, you can't charge people $250 for noncompliance with the state's order or throw them in jail for 30 days. This has gone too far. You've exceeded your authority. The entire order is out. I think you've got to manage, and that's what Wisconsin's living under now. They're living under no order. And so I think you've got to manage what people are willing to do, encourage them. But some people, I mean, I've got my mask right here. I'm wearing it here in the office. So, I think you just got to manage what – encourage people, make sure that they're doing everything that they can do. But ultimately, it's really hard to send the police out out to the public to enforce some of these rules if they're just not going to be commonsensical about it.
And to Mike's point there, is it essentially the same thing that if – Eric Holcomb said you have to wear a mask versus Eric Holcomb saying you really should wear a mask. Is the end result essentially going to be the same? Some people are going to follow it and some people just aren't?
I think that's probably right. And nobody is interested in locking people up for not following it. They want to catch the virus. That's their business. But everybody should be encouraged to wear it. We have more cases per 100,000 than the surrounding states, and it's not sufficient to say we have an unhealthier population. Okay, we have an unhealthier population. We have to react to that. I mean, this country has 5% of the world's population, 25% of the cases, and 30% of all of the deaths. So we're not doing what we need to be doing, and we don't have any leadership from Washington, so it is incumbent upon the governors to provide that. And that means he has to stand up to the right wing of his own party and say, wear masks. We're not going to lock you up. We may not even fine you, but he needs to be unequivocal in stating that masks can help protect you. And he hasn't done that.
Well, I think certainly Dr. Box has, and the governor has been following her advice in a lot of this. But the Indiana Department of Education is rejecting the latest guidance from Federal Education Secretary Betsy DeVos about how to share emergency school funding with private schools. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay explains the federal guidance spurred pushback from education leaders at all levels.
The U.S. Department of Education's guidance would reduce emergency funding available for low-income public schools and increase the amount for private schools. The federal instruction says districts should share the funding with local private schools based on total enrollment. The state estimates that would make more than $15 million accessible to private schools in Indiana. Last week, state officials expressed concerns about the federal guidance. Now, the state education department is telling school districts to ignore it. That means sharing with private schools based on their number of low-income students instead of total enrollment. That leaves just under $5 million in emergency funding available for private schools.
John Schwanes, Governor Holcomb, when asked about this specific issue, said that he would talk with State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick about the guidance she gave to schools. So is there a fight looming there?
I wouldn't think so. I don't think it's a fight he'd want to pick, because he may end up on the losing side, both legally and in terms of the court of public opinion. You know, it's other states are unhappy about this too, education officials. They may not have been as blatant in thumbing the nose at Betsy DeVos, but in Montana, hardly a bastion of liberalism. And in Pennsylvania and Louisiana, you're seeing a similar backlash. In the parish where New Orleans is, my understanding is that more than almost three-fourths or more than three-fourths of the emergency funding under the DeVos formula, let's call it that, would go to private schools, more than three-fourths. And that's clearly problematic. The reason I say it's a fight he would lose legally is again, there are other lawyers in the room, figuratively, but and I'm not. But the CARES Act says that the funds are to be distributed as Title I dollars, or as Title I dollars would be distributed, which is the aid to public education, and is given, distributed based on the volume of low-income students. So, again, no judge, no lawyer here, but. If I played one on TV, I'd say this is pretty clear cut that Jennifer McCormick is interpreting what Congress, at least, I don't know what they intended, but that's what the statute says, to distribute it as they would Title I dollars.
Nikki Kelly, Eric Holcomb has a strong contingent in his party that is, let's say, very supportive of of private schools. So is this a fight that he needs to have at least a little bit in order to satisfy some folks in his own party?
I don't know. I think the stronger contingent are the Republicans that I hear from constantly about following the rule of law. So it would be really hard to argue that we're going to go completely against the plain words of that law and choose a whole new different interpretation and, you know, be able to do that argument with a straight face.
Mike O'Brien, I'm not going to try and have you make that argument with a straight face here. So I'll just say this. It does seem that the law is on Jennifer McCormick's side. Will this be the last we hear of this? Is this essentially a settled issue in your mind?
Well, I think it's going to be circumstantial. I think it's going to depend if you have a private school that's failing for this reason or something along those lines would happen. You know, I do think that private schools have more resources and more options than the public schools. I mean, the public schools need these dollars desperately. You may have private schools with endowments or alumni that are willing to step in and help the school if it's in need. So I think in the dire cases, it may resurface.
All right, we have to move on here for time. The Indiana Republican Party's 2020 state convention will be virtual. The party officially announced the change this week in compliance with COVID-19 guidelines. The state's Back on Track plan will likely restrict gatherings to no more than 250 people by June 19th, when the state GOP convention is scheduled. And since the event typically attracts more than 1,000 delegates, party chair Kyle Hupfer says it's a no-go. Instead, Indianapolis TV station Wish will broadcast and live stream the convention on June 18th. It will feature addresses from Governor Holcomb and Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch. It will also include speeches from each of the Republican candidates seeking the Attorney General nomination. Voting in that race will then take place by mail. Normally, candidates chosen at a convention square off in multiple rounds until one person earns a majority of votes cast. This year's system will allow delegates to rank the candidates by order of preference to determine a winner. Mike O'Brien, this is really seemingly the only responsible thing that the party can do. But are you concerned that delegates are going to be confused by this ranked choice system?
No, I think you're going to have candidates who are pretty aggressively out there communicating with delegates and their supporters how to do this and how to do it properly. It essentially reduces the paper, what we do in the convention hall every 2 years anyway, with maybe the exception of kind of that in-the-moment deal cutting when that low candidate drops off and then indicates their support to another to other candidates. Some of that's going to have to be figured out on the front end.
Ann Delaney, do you think this, obviously the big race we're watching there is the AG race. Do you think this changes the odds for Curtis Hill to get the renomination?
No, I don't think it affects it at all. And I'm glad to see the Republicans took a page from the Democratic book by doing this virtually and doing mail-in. And I hope they're going to make mail-in voting available in November as well to make it convenient for voters.
Well, Secretary of State Connie Lawson asked that question today, said there's still a lot of time to figure that out. And that Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, if I said that correctly, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.